Steven Tyler, Joe Perry, Brad Whitford, Tom Hamilton, and Joey Kramer will let you play with toys in the attic.
An album like this is what it is, man, because of how it was made. And the amount of time that was spent on these songs and recording this record, that is the reason why it is what it is today and why it stands up, and it'll stand up 10 years down the line from now.
Hi, I'm Brad Whitford.
And I'm Joey Kramer of Aerosmith.
Hi, this is Steven Tyler, and you're in the studio with the Bad Boys in Aerosmith, Toys in the Attic.
Personally, I couldn't believe what a sonic improvement the Boston-based band Aerosmith had made on their second album, 1974's Get Your Wings. Aerosmith had inverted the dreaded sophomore jinx and actually improved on a promising, if not raw, debut. All Music Guide writer Stephen Thomas Erlewine is spot on when he notes, and I quote, "After nearly getting off the ground with Get Your Wings, Aerosmith finally perfected their mix of Stonesy raunch and Led Zeppelin-esque riffing with their third album, Toys in the Attic. The success of that album derives from a combination of an increased sense of songwriting skills and purpose." Erlewine sums up, "Before Aerosmith's Toys in the Attic, no other hard rock band sounded like this," end quote. And in the studios, Joe Rhodes, now a contributor to the New York Times and TV Guide, called Aerosmith America's most influential hard rock band, and the album, Toys in the Attic, the standard by which American hard rock albums are judged. Rolling Stone magazine writers ranked Toys in the Attic at number 229 on the top 500 all-time list. But Aerosmith lead singer and lyricist Steven Tyler reminded us that in 1975, a lot of the mainstream media simply missed the point.
Regardless of what it's singing the words are, regardless of whether it's in tune or not, if the attitude's there, that's rock and roll. That's why, you know, parents and older people and you know, L7s and Squaros don't understand rock and roll, because they, first of all, they spend all their time intellectualizing on it and criticizing what they don't understand, and they forget that it's attitude. Rock and roll is all pure attitude, man.
Yeah.
title song from Aerosmith's 1975 third album, Toys in the Attic. The preceding album, Get Your Wings, a transitional one for the band, was light years ahead of the debut in sound because of producer Jack Douglas. It was Jack Douglas who oversaw the making of Aerosmith's breakthrough third album, Toys in the Attic, in 1975. Here's Aerosmith drummer Joey Kramer.
What was amazing about Jack is that sometimes we'd be looking for a sound for a song, and he would find something, but not what he was looking for. This always amazed me, because he would come up with a sound, and it would be an amazing sound, and I would go, wow, that sounds incredible. And Jack would go, no, that's not what I'm looking for. Let's save it. And we would come back to it, believe it or not, to that at some later date and use it somewhere else. You know, he would like always experiment and find things, but he would put them in some sort of an order where we would come back and we'd be able to use them and keep track of it. We would sit for hours and work on drum sounds. We would sit, you know, I mean, we really spent... An album like this is what it is, man, because of how it was made. And the amount of time that was spent on these songs and recording this record that is the reason why it is what it is today and why it stands up, and it'll stand up 10 years down the line from now. Because the amount of effort and work and love and sweat that went into it was what it was.
Blood stains the ivies of my daddy's bed.
Aerosmith guitarist Brad Whitford talks about his guitar cohort Joe Perry on the song No More, No More.
That's one of, there's a tuning, Joe, one of Joe's tunings that the intro came out of, and of course the main riff was something that he wrote. Of course, the No More, No More business. It's just, Steven starts shouting one day and it just works, you know. I don't remember much about that. One thing I do know is that I think that's one of the classics. To me, it's got one of Joe's best guitar solos on the end that he ever played. And the way Jack Douglas recorded it, I mean, I just love the sound of his guitar in the end. The song's great. I always wait to hear him play that.
Ship with fate, said let's give it a try.
The song Adam's Apple comes from Aerosmith's Spring 1975 third album, Toys in the Attic. Up next, Steven Tyler reveals which of the songs on this breakthrough album was dealing with the subject of child molestation. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard in the studio with Brad Whitford, Steven Tyler, and Joey Kramer of Aerosmith for the anniversary of Toys in the Attic.
Hi, I'm Brad Whitford.
And Steven Tyler with Redbeard.
And I'm Joey Kramer of Aerosmith, and we are in the studio for Toys in the Attic.
Thank you, gentlemen. Child molestation was unfortunately just as much a problem then as it is now. It's just that in 1975, the subject was taboo for song lyrics, according to Aerosmith's Steven Tyler.
Uncle Salty's about Tom coming to me with this line and me with a fantasy and writing about some guy that worked in some old guy, like a custodian guy, that became real close with the kids in a foster home. And his name was Uncle Salty. Everyone called him Uncle Salty, but meanwhile, he really wanted to get into this little girl's pants. It was a real lecher thing of me. But that's how it came out, Uncle Salty. I mean, yeah, it has to do with, where your mind is. Sometimes it never, ever comes out that way. Listen to it. Ooh, it's a sunny day outside my window. This girl's told him her deepest, darkest secrets, and now he wants to come on to her, and she's looking out the window, and it's raining. She's crying. Ooh, it's a sunny day outside my window. See, but I'm singing sunny day, and I'm thinking rainy. So, I mean, when I say it's deep, it's deeper than deep.
Thank you.
40 years before the media knew about kiddie porn and pedophile priests, Aerosmith sang about Uncle Salty on the album Toys in the Attic. According to the excellent Joe Perry autobiography, Rocks, My Life in and Out of Aerosmith, one of the most complex, unique individuals the good Lord has ever made is Steven Tallarico, who we know as Aerosmith lead singer and songwriter Steven Tyler.
I think so. It's real good for my head because when I was growing up, I learned to water ski and I climbed trees and I had a go-kart and I had a mini bike and we went along the aqueduct and Yonkers and all that stuff. You know, I couldn't afford tanks back then, but I mean, Joe Perry and I, when we were little kids, would go in Lake Sunapee and go down and he would tie a big pot that you boil spaghetti in down on the bottom and hold it down there with rocks. And then I would go down with a hose and blow air up into it so we could swim down to it and go up underneath it and breathe and then stay down there for about 5 minutes or so.
You must have been watching Lloyd Bridges and Sea Hunt.
No, but I mean, that's how I grew up as a kid. I used to trap, too. I used to sell my skins to Montgomery Ward. I used to trap raccoons and I had a crow for a pet. And I mean, I used to mow lawns to make money and shovel sidewalks. I mean, that's, people don't know that side of me. And so, I started, becoming successful in the music business and I put all that stuff away. I forgot about it. And so now I go out, I like to go, hand gliding and jet skiing. And, you know, I like to do all that. It's the natural thing for me to do now.
Aerosmith guitarist Brad Whitford confirms it.
Going through life, you have to learn acceptance. You have to learn to accept lots of things. And people are something that you learn to accept. People are it's a wide variety out there. And, believe me, if there was anybody out there who would want to groom you, I suppose it would be Steven. Even perfect strangers, you know. I mean, he'd walk up to a guy in a wheelchair and say, I know you can walk. And believe me, I've seen him do it, you know. So it's like, no matter... It's just, that's one of Steven's funniest quirks. He'd go, why do you do it that way? He'd go, man, because that's the way I do it, you know?
We'll be right back.
way before that song ever became a song, I can remember Tom playing that thing all the time. You know, the thing he's playing. I can remember him playing that all the time, and it never went anywhere, and he never said, hey, let's use this for a song. It was just, you know, he was always something like, you know, if somebody would be diddling around or talking at a low volume, I'd always hear that. Always. I can remember him, you know, it was around for a long while. And then, you know, it's not Steven or somebody picked up on it, and, you know, and off it went.
Inspired by a Tom Hamilton bass guitar finger exercise, the classic Sweet Emotion from Aerosmith's Toys in the Attic. Up next, what role did a song off of their first album that flopped twice play in making Toys in the Attic a hit? Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Aerosmith in the studio, dusting off Toys in the Attic.
Hi, I'm Brad Whitford.
And Steven Tyler with Redbeard.
And I'm Joey Kramer of Aerosmith, and we are in the studio for Toys in the Attic.
Again, thank you guys. This is the anniversary of Toys in the Attic. Now, over 8 million copies sold. Every time I hear Aerosmith's Dream On playing on TV in a car commercial, for instance, I have to smile. Joey Kramer and Brad Whitford of Aerosmith smile, too.
You know, we became a real, true, genuine headlining act, in my opinion. It was not until we did Toys. The first two albums, the first album really never went anywhere. Until Dream On was re-released three or four times.
When this record came out.
Dream On was a single when this record came out. That's when Dream On hit. And it was off the first album. You see, so the second album, and there was nothing really that happened off of this. What happened off the second album?
Nothing.
We had some CHR stuff, which Song and Dance and Train, yeah. But it wasn't, you know, a, quote, a hit single. And then when Toys in the Attic came out, Dream On had just hit, and then Toys came out, but that was from the first album. No one knew that was re-released for the third time from the first album. Then everybody started listening to Toys, and that was indeed a great record, and that's when we hit. So it was actually pretty much well on our way to the third record down the line. So to me, that's not overnight. I mean, we were kicking around for, you know... Toys was out in 70. Was it 75?
Yes.
Okay, so, yeah. And the band, so we were kicking around for 4 or 5 years before it really happened.
This is great because guys are interviewing us for vacation, you know, you have such an illustrious career, and your greatest albums, and you know, Toys in the Attic, and da da da. And this is right up there with a bunch of them. It's interesting on this record, it's the first time you've ever used horns. Wrong! They did, you know, here they're telling us about how great our albums were, they never listened to, like.
There's horns on the second album.
Big 10-inch, yeah, and Big 10-inch is like almost, you listen to that recording, it's recorded, you know, the sound, it's almost like it was done in the 40s or 50s. I mean, we really went to try and capture the original.
God needs strength one more. Believe me, this chick's no cinch. But I'd rather get her going. Big 10-inch red band that plays the blues. Well, band that plays the blues. She just loved my big 10-inch record of her favorite blues. Stop at jiving. Now whip out your big 10-inch record up. Band of players of blues. Well, a band of players of blues. She just loves my big 10-inch record on my favorite blues. I cup her with kisses. And when we in lovers clinch, she gets all excited. When she flips on my big 10-inch record up. Band of players of blues. Well, a band. My big 10-inch, making all the favorite blues.
That's Aerosmith's version of Bull Moose Jackson's 1952 R&B classic, Big 10-inch record from Toys in the Attic. Aerosmith lead singer Steven Tyler has an uncanny knack for hearing musical muffs as brilliant opportunities, according to Joey Kramer.
He'll hear you make a mistake, you know, and he'll go, "What was that?" I said, "Man, it was a mistake, man." "But what was it? That was great. What was that you just played?" For instance, if I'm on stage and, you know, and we're in the middle of a song, I make a mistake, which, of course, I never do. I make a mistake. The next time that thing comes around again, I unmistake it by playing that mistake again. And then it's no longer a mistake. And one of the things I've learned from Steven is to how to take a mistake and turn it into a thing. I've taken figures, and because of I was trying to play something and I played it wrong, he would hear it and say, "What was that?" And I'll go, "Well, it's not what I was trying to play." "Well, it doesn't matter. That's not what you were trying to play. Whatever it was that you did play was great. Play it again." And then we'll go searching for the mistake, which is always fun because then you've opened up the mistake door. And like once you're inside, it's like this room full of stuff that like, you know, sometimes I'll sit and I'll spend a half an hour, fishing around for that mistake. And then I'll finally get it and perfect it. And then it'll be in the memory bank. I'll never use it for anything, but it's just always there. You know, but it's a good it's a good thing to get into, to just be aware of mistakes.
Likewise, Steven Tyler gives high marks to bass player Tom Hamilton.
Because he writes these things on a bass guitar or on the acoustic, you know, so it's real melodic. For a guy with a not-so-melodic ear, he comes up with the damnedest things, and he has never ceased to amaze me. He comes up with the greatest.
He seems like a gentle guy.
He is. He's the voice of reason in the band. It's like the Lord High Doodledum. Tom Hamilton.
The
is
Lord
like,
High Doodledum.
I swear to God, man, I look over to him all the time for. He's the most grounded. And sometimes I make fun of him, say, "Yeah, you're the biggest square in the world." But he's really a good grounded person. He's a little less. Yeah, he's more grounded than any one of us, I think. And Brad's really come out of a major shell. He's super grounded. Another guy that. I wanted to beat the shit out of him for being so quiet in the 70s, and now he comes out a sage.
So now, 40 years after Toys in the Attic became Aerosmith's first gold, first platinum, now 8 million seller, it's pretty much rock legend why guitarist Brad Whitford became so quiet in the latter half of the 70s. It wasn't that he had nothing to say. Rather, Brad was speechless.
It was surreal, for sure. It was so surreal that I couldn't comment on it, you know. I mean, I really couldn't. I mean, there were so many things. I mean, when I saw the movie about Sid Vicious, when I saw the movie Spinal Tap, I mean, everybody sat in theaters laughing or sat in theaters going, "Oh, can you believe this girl? Or can you, that's not real." And I watched those movies and I said, "Oh, that part of that's my life. For real." You know, people might think nobody could be like that. Nobody could be like Sid and his girlfriend. Those kind of things didn't happen. That kind of stuff in Spinal Tap, that's so hokey. Sorry, but it did and it does. And we lived it. And that's in the 70s, I sat in amazement, unable to. I mean, it was like, well, you know, that, you know, it was just like, wow, I can't believe this.
Brad used to be really quiet, but he's one of those guys, you know, that would talk with his guitar. And that was the one place where he always had my respect right from the get-go. And we always related on a playing level before anything else, you know, and that mutual respect was always there. And we've all opened that passageway up to one another, and we all learn from each other. But as far as that one really important thing, for me, which was, it's been really a difficult lesson for me because being around, like, you know, we have certain meetings that we have or just trying to discuss things or, you know, that there are five very, very different personalities in this band. You know, we're all, and everyone is very much an individual entity. And it's the only case in context that I know of myself where the pie is a whole with only the five of us, and it doesn't matter who you take or who you replace them with. The pie is just not the same without the five pieces that are there now. I mean, we actually had to learn that lesson the hard way ourselves, but we learned it that hard way, and we learned it real well. And now the pie is whole, and it will remain whole. ¶¶
gonna be changing your ways. I met a cheerleader, was a real young breed. All the times I can reminisce. All the best things of loving with a sister and a cousin. Only started with a little kiss like this.
And I remember reading in the paper, rock and roll lyrics today are horrible. Why can't they be more fashionable and right to the point and without
really
dirty language and four-letter words like Steven, like Aerosmith, and Walk This Way? And I'm thinking, she was a cheerleader, a real young bleeder, the times I could reminisce, the best thing assistant, with a loving sister and a cousin. Come on, it's like, again, and I love everything everybody else does, only I don't mind talking about it. And it just came out in Walk This Way.
That's Aerosmith with Walk This Way from Toys in the Attic. Not only did Walk This Way become Aerosmith's first top 10 hit in early 1976, but a decade after that, it was the metal core of an amalgam of rock and rap by Run DMC, who conspired with those other three capital letters, MTV, to pay collective homage to and relaunch the career of America's greatest hard rock band, Aerosmith. Here's Aerosmith drummer Joey Kramer.
When we did Toys, Toys was really, it was a mark for us, is the way that I remember it, because we were just becoming aware of like sounds and the fact that the recording studio could do things for you and this and that. And we were starting to take advantage, and we were fortunate at the time because Jack was on the level that he was being a producer, the same as we were as being the players. You know, but Jack was always very, very open to ideas. He was always willing to experiment. He might have been like, you know,
our George Martin to an extent, you know, because he would always listen to, and even if an idea didn't get used or exploited or whatever, Jack was always willing to listen to it, and he'd go the distance to get your idea, to, you know, bring it up and see whether or not it did sound okay or if it did work. And by virtue of him being that way, there was a lot of communication, and we would try things in the studio that, I mean, even today, I mean, people would think, they'd go, you know, how'd you get this sound, you know? And we go, well, we did this and this and this and this and that. And they'd say, oh, yeah, well, I can just do this and this now and get that same sound, you know? Wrong, they can't. They think they can, but they can't. Oh, baby.
Rock.
That is some hot stuff. No More, No More, live in Las Vegas in 2002 from Aerosmith. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, Steven Tyler, Brad Whitford, and Joey Kramer of Aerosmith. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2015, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.